Well, that's easy. Any particular spot? Southeast corner, if you can. Okay, here we go. Malloy shoved the cyclic left and forward, dropping the helo like a fast elevator, darting for the range building like a falcon after a pheasant. And, like a falcon, pulling up sharply at the right spot, transitioning into hover so quickly that the co-pilot in the left seat turned to look in amazement at how fast he'd brought it off. "How's that, Clark?" "Not too bad," Rainbow Six allowed. Next, Malloy applied power to get the hell out of Dodge City. Almost, but not quite, as though he hadn't stopped over the building at all. "I can improve that once I get used to your people, how fast they get out and stuff, but a long-line deployment is usually better, as you know." "As long as you don't blow the depth perception and run us right into the friggin' wall," Chavez observed. That remark earned him a turned head and a pained expression. "My boy, we do try to avoid that. Ain't nobody does the rocking chair maneuver better than me, people." "It's hard to get right," Clark observed. "Yes, it is," Malloy agreed. "But I know how to play the piano, too." The man was not lacking in confidence, they saw. Even the lieutenant in the left seat thought he was a little overpowering, but he was taking it all in anyway, especially watching how Malloy used the collective to control power as well as lift. 20 minutes later, they were back on the ground. "And that's about how it's done, people," Malloy told them, when the rotor stopped turning. "Now, when do we start real training?" "Tomorrow soon enough," Clark asked. "Works for me, General, sir. Next question, do we practice on the Nighthawk, or do I have to get used to flying something else?" "We haven't worked that out yet," John admitted. "Well, that does have a bearing on this stuff, you know. Every chopper has a different feel, and that matters on how I do my deliveries," Malloy pointed out. "I'm at my best on one of those. I'm nearly as good with a Huey, but that one's noisy in close and hard to be covert with. Others, well, I have to get used to them. Takes a few hours of yankin' and bankin' before I feel completely comfortable." Not to mention learning where all the controls were, Malloy didn't add, since no two aircraft in the entire world had all the dials, gauges, and controls in the same places, something aviators had bitched about since the Wright brothers. "If we deploy, I'm risking lives, mine and others, every time I lift off. I'd prefer to keep those risks to a minimum. I'm a cautious guy, you know." "I'll work on that today," Clark promised. "You do that." Malloy nodded and walked off to the locker ready room. Popoff had himself a fine dinner in an Italian restaurant half a block from his apartment building, enjoyed the crisp weather in the city, and puffed on a Monte Cristo cigar after he got back to his flat. There was still work to do. He'd obtained videotapes of the news coverage of both of the terrorist incidents he'd instigated, and wanted to study them. In both cases, the reporters spoke German, the Swiss kind, then Austrian, which he spoke like a native of Germany. He sat in an easy chair with the remote control in his hand, occasionally rewinding to catch something odd of passing interest, studying the tapes closely, his trained mind memorizing every detail. The most interesting parts, of course, were those showing the assault teams who'd finally resolved both incidents with decisive action. The quality of the pictures was poor. Television simply didn't make for high-quality imagery, especially in bad lighting conditions and from 200 meters away. With the first tape, that of the Bern case, there was no more than 90 seconds of pre-action pictures of the assault team. This part had not been broadcast during the attack, only afterward. The men moved professionally, in a way that somehow reminded the Russian of the ballet, so strangely delicate and stylized were the movements of the men in the black clothing, as they crept in from left and right. And then came the blindingly swift action punctuated by jerky camera movements, when the explosives went off. That always made the cameramen jump. No sound of gunfire. So their firearms were silenced. It was done so that the victims could not learn from the sound where the shots had come from. But it had not really been a matter of importance in this case, since the terrorist criminals had been dead before the information could have done them any good. But that was how it was done. This business was as programmed as any professional sport, with the rules of play enforced by deadly might. The mission over in seconds, the assault team came out, and the Bern City Police went in to sort out the mess. The people in black acted unremarkably, he saw, like disciplined soldiers on a battlefield. No congratulatory handshakes or other demonstrations. No, they were too well trained for that. No one even did so much as light a cigarette. Ah, one did seem to light a pipe. What followed was the usual brainless commentary from the local news commentators, talking about this elite police unit and how it had saved all the lives of those inside. Und those a weiter, Popov thought, rising to switch tapes. The Vienna mission, he saw, had even poorer TV coverage, due to the physical conditions of the chap's house. Quite a nice one, actually. The Romanovs might have had such a fine country house. Here the police had ruthlessly controlled the TV coverage, which was perfectly sensible, Popov thought, but not overly helpful to him. The taped coverage showed the front of the country house with boring regularity, punctuated by the monotonous words of the TV reporter repeating the same things endlessly, telling his viewers that he was unable to speak very much with the police on the scene. The tape did show the movement of vehicles, and showed the arrival of what had to be the Austrian assault team. Interestingly, they appeared to be dressed in civilian clothing upon their arrival, and changed soon thereafter into their battle dress. It looked green for this team. No, he realized. Green overgarments over black regular dress. Did that mean anything? The Austrians had two men with scope-sighted rifles who rapidly disappeared into cars, which must have taken them behind the Schloss. The assault team leader, not a very large man, much like the one Popov thought had headed the team in Bern, was seen from a great distance going over papers. The map, diagram, plans of the house and grounds, no doubt. Then, shortly before midnight, all of them had disappeared, leaving Popov to look at a tape of the dwelling illuminated by huge light standards, accompanied by more idiotic speculation by a singularly ill-informed TV journalist. And then, just after midnight, came the distant pop of a rifle, followed by two more pops, silence, and then frantic activity by the uniformed police in the camera's field of view. 20 of them raced into the front door carrying light machine guns. The reporter had then talked about a sudden burst of activity, which the thickest of viewers would have seen for themselves, followed by more nothing at all, and then the announcement that all the hostages were alive, and all the criminals dead. Another passage of time, and the green and black-clad assault team appeared again. As with Bern, there were no overt signs of self-congratulation. One of the assault team seemed to be puffing on a pipe, as he walked to the van that had brought them to the scene and stowed his weapons, while another of them conferred briefly with a civilian-clothed policeman, probably the Captain Altmark, who'd had field command of the incident. The two must have known each other. Their exchange of words was so brief before the paramilitary police team departed the scene, just as at Bern. Yes, both of the counter-terror units trained from exactly the same book, Popov told himself again. Later press coverage spoke of the skill of the special police unit. That had happened in Bern, too, but it was surprising in neither case, since reporters also spoke the same drivel, regardless of language or nationality. The words used in the statement by the police were almost identical. Well, someone had trained both teams, perhaps the same agency. Perhaps the German GSG-9 group, which, with British help, had ended the airplane incident at Mogadishu over 20 years before, had trained the forces of countries that shared their language. Certainly the thoroughness of the training and the coldness of demeanor of the assault teams struck Popov as very German. They'd acted like machines both before and after the attacks, arriving and leaving like ghosts, with nothing left behind but the bodies of the terrorists. Efficient people, the Germans, and the Germanic policemen whom they trained. Popov, a Russian by birth and culture, had little love for the nation that had once killed so many of his countrymen. But he could respect them and their work, and the people they killed were no loss to the world. Even when he'd helped to train them as an active duty officer of the Soviet KGB, he'd not cared much for them, nor had anyone else in his agency. They were, if not exactly the useful fools Lenin had once spoken about, then trained attack dogs to be unleashed when needed, but never really trusted by those who semi-controlled them. And they'd never really been all that efficient. About the only thing they'd really accomplished was to force airports to install metal detectors, inconveniencing travelers all over the world. Certainly they'd made life hard on the Israelis, but what really did that country matter on the world stage? And even then, what had happened? If you forced countries to adapt to adverse circumstances, it happened swiftly. So now, El Al, the Israeli airline, was the safest and most secure in the world, and policemen the world over were better briefed on whom to watch and to examine closely. And if everything else failed, then the policemen had special counter-terror units like those who'd settled things in Bern and Vienna. Trained by Germans to kill like Germans. Any other terrorists he sent out to do evil work would have to deal with such people.
Too bad, Popov thought, turning his TV back to a cable channel while the last tape rewound. He hadn't learned much of anything from reviewing the tapes, but he was a trained intelligence officer, and therefore a thorough man. He poured himself an absolute vodka to drink neat. He missed the superior Starka brand he would have had in Russia, and allowed his mind to churn over the information while he watched a movie on the TV screen. "Yes, General, I know," Clark said into the phone at 1:05 the next afternoon, damning time zones as he did so. "That comes out of my budget, too," General Wilson pointed out. "First," Sink Snake thought, "they ask for a man, then they ask for hardware, and now they are asking for funding, too." "I can try to help with that through Ed Foley, sir, but the fact of the matter is that we need the asset to train with." "You did send us a pretty good man," Clark added, hoping to assuage Wilson's renowned temper. It didn't help much. "Yes, I know he's good. That's why he was working for me in the first goddamn place." "This guy's getting ecumenical in his old age," John told himself. "Now he's praising a Marine. Rather unusual for an Army snake-eater and former commander of 18th Airborne Corps. General, sir, you know we've had a couple of jobs already, and with all due modesty, my people handled them both pretty damned well. I have to fight for my people, don't I?" And that calmed Wilson down. They were both commanders, they both had jobs to do, and people to command, and defend. "Clark, I understand your position, I really do. But I can't train my people on assets that you've taken away." "How about we call it time-sharing?" John offered, as a further olive branch. "It still wears out a perfectly good Nighthawk. It also trains up the crews for you. At the end of this, you may just have a primo helicopter crew to bring down to Bragg to work with your people. And the training expense for your operation is just about nothing, sir." And that, he thought, was a pretty good play. At MacDill Air Force Base, Wilson told himself that this was a losing proposition. Rainbow was a bulletproof operation, and everyone knew it. This Clark guy had sold it first of all to CIA, then to the president himself. And sure enough, they'd had two deployments, and both had worked out, though the second one had been pretty dicey. But Clark, clever as he was, and good commander that he seemed to be, hadn't learned how to run a unit in the modern military world, where half the time was spent managing money like some goddamned white-socked accountant, instead of leading from the front and training with the troops. That's what really rankled Sam Wilson, young for a four-star, a professional soldier who wanted to soldier, something that high command pretty well precluded, despite his fitness and desire. Most annoying of all, this Rainbow unit promised to steal a lot of his own business. The Special Operations Command had commitments all over the world, but the international nature of Rainbow meant that there was now somebody else in the same line of work, whose politically neutral nature was supposed to make their use a lot more palatable to countries that might need special services. Clark might just put him out of business in a real sense, and Wilson didn't like that at all. But really, he had no choice in the matter, did he? "Okay, Clark, you can use the aircraft so long as the parent unit is able to part with it, and so long as its use by you does not interfere with training and readiness with that parent unit. Clear?"
"Yes, sir, that is clear," John Clark acknowledged.
"I need to come over to see your little circus," Wilson said next.
"I'd like that a lot, General."
"We'll see," Wilson grumbled, breaking the connection.
"Tough son of a bitch," John breathed.
"Quite," Stanley agreed. "We are poaching on his patch, after all."
"It's our patch now, Al."
"Yes, it is, but you mustn't expect him to like that fact."
"And he's younger and tougher than me?"
"A few years younger, and I personally would not wish to cross swords with the gentleman." Stanley smiled.
"The war appears to be over, John, and you appear to have won."
Clark managed a smile and a chuckle.
"Yeah, Al, but it's easier to go into the field and kill people."
"Quite."
"What's Peter's team doing?"
"Long line practice."
"Let's go and watch," John said, glad to have an excuse to leave his desk.
"I want to get out of this place," he told his attorney.
"I understand that, my friend," the lawyer replied, with a look around the room. It was the law in France, as in America, that conversations between clients and attorneys were privileged, and could not be recorded or used in any way by the state. But neither man really trusted the French to abide by that law, especially since DGSE, the French intelligence service, had been so instrumental in bringing Ilyich to justice. The DGSE was not known for its willingness to abide by the rules of civilized international behavior, as people as diverse as international terrorists and Greenpeace had learned to their sorrow. Well, there were other people talking in this room, and there were no obvious shotgun microphones here, and the two had not taken the seats offered by the prison guards, opting instead for one closer to the windows, because, they'd said, they'd wanted the natural light. Of course, every booth could easily be wired.
"I must tell you that the circumstances of your conviction do not lend themselves to an easy appeal," the lawyer advised. This wasn't exactly news to his client.
"I am aware of that. I need you to make a telephone call."
"To whom?"
The jackal gave him a name and a number.
"Tell him that it is my wish to be released."
"I cannot be part of a criminal act."
"I am aware of that as well," Sanchez observed coldly.
"Tell him also that the rewards will be great."
It was suspected, but not widely known for certain, that Ilyich Ramirez Sanchez had a goodly sum of money squirreled away as a result of his operations while a free man. This had come mainly as a result of his attack on the OPEC ministers in Austria almost 20 years earlier, which explained why he and his group had been so careful not to kill anyone really important, despite the political flap that would have caused. All the better for him to gain notice and acclaim at the time. Business was business, even for his sort of people. And someone had paid his own legal bills, the attorney thought.
What else do you expect me to tell him?
That is all.
If he has an immediate reply, you will convey it to me, the jackal told him.
There was still an intensity to his eyes, something cold and distant. But even so, right there looking deep into his interlocutor and telling him what must be. For his part, the attorney asked himself again why he'd taken on this client. He had a long history of championing radical causes, from which notoriety he'd gained a wide and lucrative criminal practice. There was an attendant element of danger involved, of course. He'd recently handled 3 major drug cases, and lost all 3. And those clients hadn't liked the idea of spending 20 or more years in prison, and had expressed their displeasure to him recently. Might they arrange to have him killed? It had happened a few times in America and elsewhere. It was a more distant possibility here, the lawyer thought, though he'd made no promises to those clients except to do his best for them. It was the same with Carlos the Jackal. After his conviction, the lawyer had come into the case to look at the possibilities of an appeal, and made it, and lost, predictably. The French high courts held little clemency for a man who'd done murder on the soil of France, then essentially boasted of it. Now the man had changed his mind and decided petulantly that he didn't enjoy prison life. The lawyer knew that he'd pass along the message, as he had to. But did that make him part of a criminal act? No, he decided. Telling an acquaintance of his client that the latter wanted out of prison, well, who would not wish to be liberated? And the message was equivocal. It held many possible meanings. Help on another appeal, revelation of new, exculpatory evidence, anything at all. And besides, whatever Sanchez asked him to do here was privileged information, wasn't it?
I will pass along your message, he promised his client. Merci.
It was a beautiful thing to watch, even in the dark. The MH-60K Nighthawk helicopter came in at about 30 miles per hour, almost 200 feet over the ground, approaching the range building from the south, into the wind, traveling smoothly. Not at all like a tactical deployment maneuver. But under the helicopter was a dark nylon rope, about 150 feet long, barely visible with the best of NVGs. And at the end of it were Peter Covington, Mike Chin, and another Team One member, dangling free below the black Sikorsky in their black ninja suits. The helicopter proceeded in so evenly and smoothly, as though on tracks, until the nose of the aircraft crossed the building's wall. Then the nose came up, and the aircraft flared, slowing rapidly. Below the aircraft, the people attached to the rope swept forward, as though on a child's swing, and then, at the limit of the arc, they swung backward. The backward swing froze them still in the air, their rearward velocity almost exactly matching the remaining forward motion of the helicopter, and then they were on the roof, almost as though they'd stepped off a stationary object. Instantly, Covington and his men unclipped their quick-release attachments and dropped down. The negligible speed difference between their feet and the stationary roof made for no noise at all. Scarcely had this been done when the helicopter nosed down, resuming its forward flight. And anyone on the ground would scarcely have known that the aircraft had done anything but fly at a steady pace over the building. And at night, it was nearly invisible, even with night vision goggles.
"Bloody good," Al Stanley breathed. Not a bloody sound.
He is as good as he says, Clark observed.
As though hearing the remarks, Malloy brought the helicopter around, flashing a thumbs up out the window to the men on the ground as he headed off to orbit the area for the remainder of the simulation. In a real situation, the orbit would be in case he was needed to do an emergency evacuation. And even more so to get the people on the ground used to having a helicopter overhead, to make his presence as much a part of the landscape as the trees. So he'd disappear into the normal background of the night, no more remarkable than the song of nightingales, despite the danger inherent from his presence. It surprised everyone in the business that you could get away with this, but it was just an application of human nature to the world of special operations. If a tank had driven into the parking lot, after a day or two it would be just another car. Covington's trio of shooters circulated about the roof for a few minutes, then disappeared down ladders into the interior and emerged a few seconds later from the front door.
"Okay, Bear, this is Six. Exercise concluded. Back to the bird farm, Colonel. Over."
"Roger, Six. Bear is RTB. Out," was the terse reply. And the Nighthawk broke off from the orbit and headed down to the helopad.
"What do you think?" Stanley asked Major Covington.
"Bloody good. Like stepping off the train to the platform. Malloy knows what he's about. Master Chief?"
"Put him on the payroll, sir," Master Chief Chin confirmed. "That's a guy we can work with."
"The aircraft is nicely set up," Malloy said 20 minutes later in the club. He was wearing his green Nomex flight suit with a yellow scarf around his neck, like a good aviator, though it struck Clark as odd.
"What's with the necktie?"
"Oh, this? It's the A-10 scarf. One of the guys I rescued in Kuwait gave it to me. I figure it's lucky, and I've always kinda liked the Warhog as an airplane, so I wear it on missions."
"How hard is it to do that transition maneuver?" Covington asked.
"Your timing has to be pretty good, and you have to read the wind. You know what helps me prepare for it?"
"Tell me," Clark said.
"Piano playing." Malloy sipped at his pint of bitter and grinned. "Don't ask me why, but I always fly better after I've played some. Maybe something to do with getting the fingers loose. Anyway, that chopper they lent us is set up just right. Control cables have the right tension, throttles are just so. That Air Force ground crew, well, I have to meet 'em and buy 'em all around. They really know how to prepare a chopper. Good team of mechanics."
"They are that," First Lieutenant Harrison agreed.
He belonged to 1st Special Operations Wing, and technically, therefore, he was responsible for the helicopter, though now he was very pleased to have so fine a teacher as Malloy.
"That's half the battle of flying helos, getting the bird dialed in just so," Malloy went on. "That one you can just sweet-talk to her, and she listens real nice."
"Like a good rifle," Chin observed.
"Roger that, Master Chief," Malloy said, saluting with his beer.
"So what can you guys tell me about your first two missions?"
"Christians 10, Lions 1, Stanley replied.
"Who'd you lose?"
"Well, that was the Bern job. The hostage was killed before we were on the scene."
"Eager Beavers?"
"Something like that."
Clark nodded.
"They weren't real swift, crossing the line like that. I sort of thought they were just bank robbers. But later investigation turned up the terrorist connection. Of course, maybe they just wanted some cash. Dr. Bellow never really decided what they were all about.
Any way you look at it, they're just hoods, murderers, whatever you want to call them," Malloy said.
"I helped train the FBI chopper pilots. Spent a few weeks at Quantico with the hostage rescue team. They kinda indoctrinated me on the psychological side. It can be pretty interesting. This Dr. Bellow, is it Paul Bellow, the guy who wrote the 3 books?
"Same guy."
"He's pretty smart."
"Well, that's the idea, Colonel Malloy," Stanley said, waving for another round.
"But the thing is, you know, there's only one thing you really need to know about them," Malloy said,
reverting back to identity as a colonel of the United States Marine Corps. How to whack them, Master Chief Chin agreed. The Turtle Inn Bar and Lounge was something of a fixture on Columbus Avenue, between 68th and 69th, well-known and well-patronized by locals and tourists. The music was loud, but not too loud, and the area was lighted, but not very well. The booze was a little more expensive than the norm, but the added price was for the atmosphere, which, the owner would have said, was priceless.
So, the man sipped at his rum and coke. You live around here?
Just moving in, she answered, sipping her own drink. Looking for a job.
What do you do?
Legal secretary.
A laugh. Lots of room for that here. We got more lawyers and we got taxi drivers. Where'd you say you were from?
Des Moines, Iowa. Ever been there?
No, local boy, the man replied, lying. He'd been born in Los Angeles 30 years before. I'm an accountant with Pete Merwick. That was a lie, too. But a singles bar was a place for lies, as everyone knew. The woman was 23 or so, just out of secretarial school, brown hair and eyes, and needed to lose about 15 pounds, though she was attractive enough if you liked them short. The three drinks she'd already consumed to show that she was a burgeoning Big Apple sophisticate had her pretty mellow.
"Been here before?" he asked.
"No, first time. What about you?"
"Last few months. Nice place to meet people." Another lie, but they came easily in a place like this.
"Music's a little loud," she said.
"Well, other places it's a lot worse." "You live close?"
3 blocks north. Got a little studio apartment. Subleasing it. Rent control in the building. My stuff gets here in another week."
"So you're not really moved in yet?"
"Right."
"Well, welcome to New York."
"Anne Pretlow."
"Kirk McLean." They shook hands, and he held hers a little longer than necessary, so that she'd get a feel for his skin. A necessary precondition to casual affection, which he needed to generate. In another few minutes, they were dancing, which mainly meant bumping into people in the dark. He was turning on the charm, and she was smiling up at his 6-foot height. Under other circumstances, this could have developed into something, Kirk thought. But not tonight. The bar closed after 2 in the morning, and he walked her out. She was quite drunk now from a total of 7 drinks, barely diluted by bar peanuts and pretzel nuggets. He'd carefully nursed his 3, and eaten a lot of peanuts. "So," he asked out on the sidewalk, "let me drive you, okay?"
"It's only 3 blocks.
"Annie, it's late, and this is New York, okay? You need to learn where you can go and where you can't. Come on," he concluded, pulling her hand and leading her around the corner. His BMW was parked halfway to Broadway. He gallantly held the door open, shut it behind her, then walked around to get in himself.
"You must do okay," Anne Pretlow noted, surveying the car.
"Yeah, well, lots of people like to dodge taxes, you know." He started the car and moved out onto the cross street, actually in the wrong direction, though she was a little too much in her cups to appreciate that. He turned left on Broadway and spotted the blue van parked in a quiet spot. Half a block away, he flashed his lights, whereupon he slowed the car and pushed the button to lower both the driver's side and passenger windows.
"Hey," he said, "I know this guy."
"Huh?" Pretlow replied, somewhat confused about where they were and where they were going. It was too late for her to do much in any case. "Yo, Kirk," the man in coverall said, leaning down to the open passenger window. "Hey, buddy," McLean replied, giving a thumbs up. The man in coveralls leaned in and produced a small aerosol can from his sleeve.
Then he depressed the red plastic button and gave Ann Pretlow a blast of ether right in the face. Her eyes popped open for a second of shock and surprise. She turned to look at Kirk for a long lingering second or so, and then her body went slack.
"Be careful with the drugs, man. She's got a lot of booze in her."
"No problem." The man banged the side of the truck, and another man appeared. This one looked up and down the street for a police car, then helped open the passenger door, lifted Ann Pretlow, and carried her limp form through the rear door of the van, where she joined another young woman picked up by another company employee earlier that night. With that, McLean drove off, letting the night air blow the stink of the ether out of the car as he headed right, onto the West Side Highway and north to the George Washington Bridge. Okay, that made two he'd bagged, and the others should have gotten a total of six more by now. Another three, and they could end this most dangerous part of the operation. Chapter 11. Infrastructure. The lawyer made the call, and, unsurprisingly, found that it developed into a luncheon in a restaurant where a man of 40 or so asked a few simple questions, then left before the dessert cart was wheeled up to the table. That ended his involvement with whatever would happen. He paid the check with cash and walked back to his office haunted by the question. What had he done? What might he have started? The answer for both, he told himself forcefully, was that he didn't know. It was the intellectual equivalent of a shower after a sweaty day's work, and, though ultimately not as satisfying, he was a lawyer and accustomed to the vicissitudes of life. His interlocutor left the restaurant and caught the metro, changing trains three times before settling on the one that ran near his home, close to a park known for the prostitutes who stood about, peddling their multi-valued wares for passers-by in automobiles. If there were anywhere an indictment of the capitalist system, it was here, he thought, though the tradition went further back than the onset of the current economic system. The women had all the gaiety of serial killers, as they stood there in their abbreviated clothing, made to be removed as rapidly as possible, so as to save time. He turned away and headed to his flat, where, with luck, others would be waiting for him. And luck, it turned out, was with him. One of his guests had even made coffee. "This is where it has to stop," Carol Breitling said, even though she knew it wouldn't. "Sure, Doc," her guest said, sipping OEOB coffee. "But how the hell do you sell it to him?" The map was spread on her coffee table. East of Alaska's Prudhoe Bay was a piece of tundra, over 1,000 square miles of it, and geologists for British Petroleum and Atlantic Richfield, the two companies that had largely exploited the Alaskan North Slope, built the pipeline, and therefore helped cause the Exxon Valdez disaster, had made their public pronouncement. This oil field, called AARM, ARM, was at least double the size of the North Slope. The report, still semi-classified in the industrial sense, had come to the White House a week earlier, with confirming data from the United States Geological Survey, a federal agency tasked to the same sort of work, along with the opinion of the geologists that the field extended farther east, across the Canadian border. And exactly how far it extended they could only guess, because the Canadians had not yet begun their survey. The conclusion of the executive summary posited the possibility that the entire field could rival the one in Saudi Arabia, although it was far harder to transport oil from it. Except for the fact, the report went on, that the Trans-Alaska pipeline had already been built, and the new field would only need a few hundred miles of extension on the existing pipeline, which, the summary concluded arrogantly, had produced a negligible environmental impact. "Except for that damned tanker incident," Dr. Breitling observed into her morning coffee, "which had killed thousands of innocent wild birds and hundreds of sea otters, and had sullied several hundred square miles of pristine seacoast. "This will be a catastrophe if Congress lets it go forward. My God, Carol, the caribou, the birds, all the predators. There are polar bears there, and browns, and barren ground grizzly, and this environment is as delicate as a newborn infant. We can't allow the oil companies to go in there."
"I know, Kevin," the president's science advisor responded with an emphatic nod. "The damage might never be repaired. The permafrost, there's nothing more delicate on the face of the planet," the president of the Sierra Club said, with further repetitive emphasis. "We owe it to ourselves. We owe it to our children. We owe it to the planet. This bill has to be killed. I don't care what it takes, this bill must die. You must convince the president to withdraw any semblance of support for it. We cannot allow this environmental rape to take place."
"Kevin, we have to be smart about how we do this. The president sees this as a balance of payments issue. Domestic oil doesn't force us to spend our money buying oil from other countries. Worse, he believes the oil companies when they say they drill and transport the oil without doing great environmental damage, and that they can fix what damage they do accidentally."
"That's horseshit, and you know it, Carol." Kevin Mayflower spat out his contempt for the oil companies. "Their goddamned pipeline is a bleeding scar on the face of Alaska, an ugly, jagged steel line crossing the most beautiful land on the face of the earth, an affront to nature herself. And what for? So that people could drive motor vehicles, which further polluted the planet merely because lazy people didn't want to walk to work or ride bicycles or horses." Mayflower didn't reflect on the fact that he'd flown to Washington to deliver his plea instead of riding one of his Appaloosa horses across the country, and that his rented car had been parked on West Executive Drive. Everything the oil companies touched, they ruined, he thought. They made it dirty. They sullied the very earth itself, removing what they thought of as a precious resource here, there, and everywhere, whether it was oil or coal, gashing the earth, or poking holes into it, sometimes spilling their liquid treasure because they didn't know and didn't care about the sanctity of the planet, which belonged to everyone, and which needed proper stewardship. The stewardship, of course, required proper guidance, and that was the job of the Sierra Club and similar groups, to tell the people how important the earth was, and how they must respect and treat it. The good news was that the president's science advisor did understand, and that she did work in the White House compound, and did have access to the president. "Carol, I want you to walk across the street, go into the Oval Office, and tell him what has to be done."
"Kevin, it's not that easy."
"Why the hell not? He's not that much of a dunce, is he?"
"He occasionally has a different point of view, and the oil companies are being very clever about this."
"Look at their proposal," she said, tapping the report on the table.
"They promise to indemnify the entire operation, to put up a $1 billion bond in case something goes wrong.
For God's sake, Kevin, they even offer to let the Sierra Club be on the council to oversee their environmental protection programs.
And be outnumbered there by their own cronies.
Be damned if they'll co-opt us that way," Mayflower snarled. "I won't let anyone from my office be a part of this rape, and that's final."
"And if you say that out loud, the oil companies will call you an extremist, and marginalize the whole environmental movement, and you can't afford to let that happen, Kevin."
"The hell I can't! You have to stand and fight for something, Carol. Here is where we stand and fight. We let those polluting bastards drill oil in Prudhoe Bay, but that's it."
"What will the rest of your board say about this?" Dr. Breitling asked.
"They'll goddamned well say what I goddamned tell them to say."
"No, Kevin, they won't."
Carol leaned back and rubbed her eyes. She'd read the entire report the previous night, and the sad truth was that the oil companies had gotten pretty damn smart about dealing with environmental issues. It was plain business sense. The Exxon Valdez had cost them a ton of money, in addition to the bad public relations.
Three pages had been devoted to the changes in tanker safety procedures. Now, ships leaving the huge oil terminal at Valdez, Alaska, were escorted by tugs all the way to the open sea. A total of 20 pollution control vessels were on constant standby, with a further number in reserve. The navigation systems on every tanker had been upgraded to beyond what nuclear submarines carried. The navigation officers were compelled to test their skills on simulators every 6 months. It was all hugely expensive, but far less so than another serious spill. A series of commercials proclaimed all of these facts on television. Worst of all, the high-end intellectual cable satellite channels, History, Learning, Discovery, and A&E, for whom the oil companies were also sponsoring new shows on wildlife in the Arctic. Never touched upon what the companies did, but there were plenty of pictures of caribou and other animals traversing under the elevated portions of the pipeline. They were getting their message out very skillfully indeed, even to members of the Sierra Club's board, Breitling thought. What they didn't say, and what both she and Mayflower knew, was that once the oil was safely out of the ground, safely transported through the monster pipeline, safely conveyed over the sea by the newly double-hulled supertankers, then it just became more air pollution. Out the tailpipes of cars and trucks, and the smokestacks of electric power stations. So it really was all a joke, and that joke included Kevin's bitching about hurting the permafrost. At most, what would be seriously damaged? 10 or 20 acres, probably. And the oil companies would make more commercials about how they cleaned that up, as though the polluting end use of the oil was not an issue at all. Because to the ignorant Joe Sixpack, sitting there in front of his TV, watching football games, it wasn't an issue, was it? There were 100 or so million motor vehicles in the United States, and a larger number across the world, and they all polluted the air, and that was the real issue. How did one stop that from poisoning the planet? Well, there were ways, weren't there? She reflected.
"Kevin, I'll do my best," she promised. "I will advise the President not to support this bill."
The bill was S-1768, submitted and sponsored by both Alaskan senators, whom the oil companies had bought long before, which would authorize the Department of the Interior to auction off the drilling rights into the AAMP area. The money involved would be huge, both for the federal government and for the state of Alaska. Even the Native American tribes up there would look the other way. The money they got from the oil would buy them lots of snowmobiles with which to chase and shoot the caribou, and motorboats to fish and kill the odd whale, which was part of their racial and cultural heritage. Snowmobiles weren't needed in the modern age of plastic-wrapped USDA Choice Iowa beef, but the Native Americans clung to the end result of their traditions, if not the traditional methods. It was a depressing truth that even these people had set aside their history and their very gods in homage to a new age of mechanistic worship to oil and its products. Both the Alaskan senators would bring down tribal elders to testify in favor of S-1768, and they would be listened to, since who more than Native Americans knew what it was like to live in harmony with nature? Only today they did it with Ski-Doo snowmobiles, Johnson outboard motors, and Winchester hunting rifles. She sighed at the madness of it all. "Will he listen?" Mayflower asked, getting back to business. Even environmentalists had to live in the real world of politics. "Honest answer? Probably not," Carol Breitling admitted quietly. "You know," Kevin observed in a low voice, "there are times when I understand John Wilkes Booth." "Kevin, I didn't hear that, and you didn't say it. Not here. Not in this building."
"Damn it, Carol, you know how I feel. And you know I'm right. How the hell are we supposed to protect the planet if the idiots who run the world don't give a fuck about the world we live on?"
"What are you going to say? That Homo sapiens is a parasitic species that hurts the earth and the ecosystem?"
But we don't belong here?
A lot of us don't, and that's a fact.
Maybe so, but what do you do about it?
I don't know, Mayflower had to admit.
Some of us know, Carol Breitling thought, looking up into his sad eyes.
But are you ready for that one, Kevin?
She thought he was, but recruitment was always a troublesome step, even for true believers like Kevin Mayflower.
Construction was about 90% complete. There were 20 whole sections around the site, 20 one-square-mile blocks of land, mainly flat, a slight roll to it, with a four-lane paved road leading north to Interstate 70, which was still covered with trucks heading in and out. The last 2 miles of the highway were set up without a median strip, the rebarred concrete paving a full 30 inches deep, as though it had been built to land airplanes on, the construction superintendent had observed. Big ones, even. The road led into an equally sturdy and massively wide parking lot. He didn't care enough about it, though, to mention it at his country club in Salina. The buildings were fairly pedestrian, except for their environmental control systems, which were so state-of-the-art that the Navy could have used them on nuclear submarines. It was all part of the company's leading-edge posture on its systems, the chairman had told him on his last visit. They had a tradition of doing everything ahead of everyone else, and besides, the nature of their work required careful attention to every little squiggly detail. You didn't make vaccines in the open. But even the worker housing and offices had the same systems, the super thought, and that was odd, to say the least. Every building had a basement. It was a sensible thing to build here in Tornado Country, but few ever bothered with it, partly out of sloth, and partly from the fact that the ground was not all that easy to dig here, the famous Kansas hardpan whose top was scratched to grow wheat. That was the other interesting part. They'd continue to farm most of the area. The winter wheat was already in, and 2 miles away was the farm operations center, down its own overwide two-lane road, outfitted with the newest and best farm equipment he'd ever seen, even in an area where growing wheat was essentially an art form. $300 million total was going into this project. The buildings were huge. You could convert them to living space for 5,000 or 6,000 people, the super thought. The office building had classrooms for continuing education. The site had its own power plant, along with a huge fuel tank farm, whose tanks were semi-buried in deference to local weather conditions, and connected by their own pipeline to a filling point just off I-70 at Kannapolis. Despite the local lake, there were no fewer than 10 12-inch artesian wells drilled well down into and past the Cherokee aquifer that local farmers used to water their fields. Hell, that was enough water to supply a small city. But the company was footing the bill, and he was getting his usual percentage of the total job cost to bring it in on time, with a substantial bonus for coming in early, which he was determined to earn. It had been 25 months to this point, with 2 more to go. And he'd make it, the super thought, and he'd get that bonus, after which he'd take the family to Disney World for 2 weeks of Mickey and golf on the wonderful courses there, which he needed in order to get his game back in shape after 2 years of 7-day weeks. But the bonus meant he wouldn't need to work again for a couple of years. He specialized in large jobs. He'd done 2 skyscrapers in New York, an oil refinery in Delaware, an amusement park in Ohio, and 2 huge housing projects elsewhere, earning a reputation for bringing things in early and under budget. Not a bad rep for someone in his business. He parked his Jeep Cherokee and checked notes for the things remaining this afternoon. Yeah, the window seal tests in Building 1. He used his cell phone to call ahead and headed off across the landing strip, as he called it, where the access roads came together.
He remembered his time as an engineer in the Air Force. 2 miles long and almost a yard thick. Yeah, you could land a 747 on this road if you wanted. Well, the company had a fleet of its own Gulfstream business jets, and why not land them here instead of the dinky little airfield at Ellsworth? And if they ever bought a jumbo, he chuckled, they could do that here too. 3 minutes later, he was parked just outside of one. This building was complete, 3 weeks early, and the last thing to be done was the environmental checks. Fine. He walked in through the revolving door, an unusually heavy, robust one, which was immediately locked upon his entry. "Okay, we ready, Gil?"
"We are now, Mr. Hollister."
"Run her up, then," Charlie Hollister ordered. Gil Trains was the supervisor of all the environmental systems at the project. Ex-Navy, and something of a control freak, he punched the wall-mounted controls himself. There was no noise associated with the pressurization. The systems were too far away for that. But the effect was almost immediate. On the walk over to Gil, Hollister felt it in his ears. Like driving down a mountain road, your ears clicked, and you had to work your jaw around to equalize the pressure, which was announced by another click. "How's it holding?"
"So far, so good," Trains replied. 0.75 PSI overpressure. Holding steady."
His eyes were on the gauges mounted in this control station.
"You know what this is like, Charlie?"
"Nope," the superintendent admitted.
"Testing watertight integrity on a submarine. Same method. We overpressure a compartment."
"Really? It's all reminded me of stuff I did in Europe at fighter bases."
"What's that?" Gil asked.
"Overpressurizing pilots' quarters to keep gas out."
"Oh, yeah? Well, I guess it works both ways. Pressure is holding nicely."
Damned well ought to, Hollister thought, with all the hell we went through to make sure every fucking window was sealed with vinyl gaskets. Not that there were all that many windows. That had struck him as pretty odd. The views here were pretty nice. Why shut them out?
The building was specced for a full 1.3 pounds of overpressure. They told him it was tornado protection. And that sorta kinda made sense, along with the increased efficiency of the HVAC systems that came along with the seals. But it could also make for sick building syndrome. Buildings with overly good environmental isolation kept flu germs in, and helped cold spread like a goddamned prairie fire. Well, that had to be part of the idea, too. The company worked on drugs and vaccines and stuff, and that meant that this place was like a germ warfare factory, didn't it? So it made sense to keep stuff in. And keep stuff out, right? 10 minutes later, they were sure. Instruments all over the building confirmed that the overpressurization systems worked on the first trial. The guys who'd done the windows and doors had earned all that extra pay for getting it right.
"Looks pretty good. Gil, I have to run over to the uplink center." The complex also had a lavish collection of satellite communication systems.
"Use the airlock," Trains pointed.
"See you later," the super said on his way out.
"Sure thing, Charlie."
It wasn't pleasant. They now had 11 people, healthy ones, 8 women and 3 men, segregated by gender, of course, and 11 was actually one more than they'd planned. But after kidnapping them, you couldn't very well give them back. Their clothing had been taken away. In some cases, it had been removed while they'd been unconscious, and replaced with tops and bottoms that were rather like prison garb, if made of somewhat better material. No undergarments were permitted. Imprisoned women had actually used bras to hang themselves on occasion, and that couldn't be allowed here. Slippers for shoes, and the food was heavily laced with Valium, which helped to calm people down somewhat, but not completely. It wouldn't have been very smart to drug them that much, since the depression of all their bodily systems might skew the test. And they couldn't allow that either.
"What is all this?"
the woman demanded of Dr. Archer.